Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now you're very welcome along to this evening's football show. Later on we're going to check in with Paddy Agnew over in Italy, but in the meantime Simon Cooper is standing by, writes for the Financial Times as he has done for a long time now, author of Football Against the Enemy and many other pieces and books besides. You're there, Simon, how you doing?
Okay, I'm in lockdown in Paris. Haven't left the house in over a week now.
How are you finding it?
I'm finding it surprisingly pleasant. I'm lucky my children are a bit older, and so we don't have any toddlers to manage, which must be very difficult, and we have each other's company, so we watch classic films a lot. It's not been bad.
France, last time I checked, and it's an ever-changing picture, obviously, had 20,000 cases, and they were just coming up on 900 deaths, so clearly it's as serious there as it is anywhere. Is there any sense yet, watching French media, where you are on the curve?
Well, the lockdown started about just over a week ago. I mean, it happened in stages. And the streets have been deserted for a week now. And we know that it takes a couple of weeks to see that effect, given the lag in, you know, transmission, infection, and then death. So I think France acted a bit earlier than, say, Italy, Spain, or the UK. So relative to them, things are not as terrible. But of course, it's pretty, pretty drastic here. And life has completely stopped in a way that I think is not true even in Ireland. Paris has never been this deserted. I mean, so I gather, because I haven't been outside for a week, as I say.
Yeah. I do remember there's a line you said, we were speaking 4 years ago now, I think. That was the attack on the Bataclan and the Stade de France. That's 4 years ago, November, isn't it?
November 2015.
Yeah. And I do remember you saying at the time that one of the potential tragedies of that attack would be if people didn't feel safe going outside their homes, because Paris, such is the nature of Paris, small apartments and densely populated, that frankly it's a city to be enjoyed outdoors. You have to get out of your house, hence the cafe culture, hence all the parks. So 4 years on, Paris has not been enjoyed outdoors, to say the least.
No, what I've noticed, though, is it's emptied out. So the applause at 8 o'clock for the medical workers, we go onto our balcony, but it's quite tinny because so many people in the neighborhood have a country home somewhere or a cottage. You know, this is the largest country in Western Europe. There's a lot of space. So I think everyone who could get out of their little apartment and sit this one out, let's say in southern France with a bit of sunshine, has done so. So Paris is probably, it's been compared to June 1940 when there was a big exodus as well. Mm. Paris has probably not been this empty in many decades.
How is what's the perception of Macron's performance?
Well, he has become more popular in the same way as Giuseppe Conte, the Italian Prime Minister. You know, Macron exudes arrogance, and that's why he is typically disliked. But he is generally seen as a smart, competent person, which is what you'd want in this situation. Mm. And he has been able to, you know, express humanity and feeling of empathy for people who are suffering. So French president is never popular, but his approval ratings are now just over 50%, which really haven't happened in a couple of years.
I don't speak French, but I did read some of his address from last week. Maybe he's given more than one, but certainly he invoked the language of war quite a bit and used the phrase, you know, we are at war with this disease several times over.
He kept saying that, and it's partly because, war has this, of course, iconic place in French culture, especially World War One, when the whole nation was on the same side. That was not true in World War Two, but the memory of World War Two was recast very successfully that way by General de Gaulle as being, we were all in the resistance, which, of course, was false. But so when Macron uses this language of war, it speaks to French people's warmest feelings about their nation, the sense of unity, which has really disappeared in recent decades, and especially in recent years, the enormous divide between supporters of the far right and supporters of, let's say, the mainstream. Mm. So it's a more unified country than it has been.
Yeah. We are, by the way, about to talk about Johan Cruyff. I know if someone's just tuned in, they're probably not too sure what they're listening to, but these are extraordinary times. We're talking with Simon Cooper, who's over in Paris, as he has been for a number of years. Now, excuse the ignorance with this question, so I'm kind of riffing a bit off the top of my head, but the Gilets Jaunes movement, as I understand it, was in part in opposition to Macron's efforts to restructure the welfare economy in some respects. This is a time, I think, where we're all looking at the welfare economy and thinking it's very, very important. So what will the result of all this be in somewhere like France in the years ahead? I don't know.
Well, I mean, France has a very strong state. It's got the highest share of state spending relative to GDP, I think, in the world, just above Sweden. So that, at times like this, is a blessing. I mean, people are not left to their own devices in terms of healthcare as they are in the US. The government has guaranteed people's salaries. I think it's now almost impossible to fire anyone during this period. So, you know, at times like this, I think almost everyone wants a strong state. You see it also on the street, or so I gather, that policemen are out there in force asking people for their documentation. Why are you out? Are you on your one daily run? Are you going to a food shop? So this is a country that intervenes massively economically at times like this. I mean, all countries are doing that now. Mm. But France was kind of an interventionist before anyone else. So it is the kind of state you want if you're going to have a global pandemic.
Mm. I suspect people will now be increasingly attached to it for a long time to come. The memory of this will not dissipate anytime soon.
I think coronavirus is going to be something that we all look back in our different countries in decades from now. But some countries may end up with a feeling of bitterness of having been let down by their leaders, etc. Mm. I mean, all that remains to be seen. But I mean, speaking as somebody British, I wonder how the British government's performance will stand up viewed decades hence. And I think it probably won't as well as the French government so far.
No. The fact that we're all of that opinion in real time suggests that that will not be the case in decades to come as well. So Johan Cruyff, he passed away age 68 4 years ago today, which is why we wanted to chat to you. I reread your obituary in the Financial Times that you wrote of Cruyff. I think we're all aware of the story in broad strokes. So in some respects, it was the detail almost which jumped out at me 4 years on. And for instance, you made the point he had little grasp of grammar in either Dutch or Spanish. He spoke in a 1950s Amsterdam working class accent. And it's a funny thing, an assumption of mine, I suppose, is because he was so erudite when it came to football, I just half presumed for some reason he would have spoke with perfect grammar and almost with a professorial type tone. But no, it was bad grammar and working class Amsterdam accent right through his life.
Yeah, I mean, he was no Arsene Wenger in terms of sort of education and sophistication. Cruyff had left school at about 12 or 13, just after his father died, which was a great tragedy of his life. His father was a grocer in Amsterdam East, and they lived a few hundred yards from the old Ajax stadium. The father supplied Ajax with fruit. And Cruyff, from toddlerdom on, would kind of walk over to the Ajax ground, and he'd hang out with the manager. He'd, you know, steal the motorbikes of the first team players. He'd have lunch at the coaches' homes, because Ajax always had an English coach then, so they'd have a warm English meal at lunchtime, whereas the Dutch have sandwiches at lunchtime. He learned pretty good English, which actually was probably his best language, grammatically. And so he was an entirely self-tutored autodidact. And because he was a genius in terms of understanding space, and seeing football as a kind of geometry or a kind of choreography, he reinvented football. And because he had a small vocabulary, he always struggled to explain his thinking. You know, so his pupil was Pep Guardiola, who's a much more educated man who was able to systematize his thinking about football. And Guardiola is really, he's not the original thinker. Cruyff was the original thinker, and Guardiola systematizes and updates his thinking. And Cruyff, I mean, you know, he could never have written down on a piece of paper or given a kind of presentation with a PowerPoint explaining what he thought. So what you have are these kind of ungrammatical, brilliant explanations of how football actually works.
And could you follow what he was saying? I mean, like, were they digestible, or were you left a little bit scratching your head and you would almost have to draw a diagram?
I grew up in the Netherlands, and, you know, when I was 12, he came back in 1981 as a player to Ajax. And from then on, he would give these interviews, because from about the age of 30, he was old by then. He was 34 when he came back. But from about the age of 30, he had begun to understand. He was able to verbalize what he'd always understood about football. And so he began to explain it. And it was very weird language. So he would always refer to himself as you. He said that was the great tragedy of your career, that you always saw everything better, he'd say, for example. it meant that you were always criticizing, always in conflict, and he was always in conflict with everyone. So we kind of learned, everyone who loved football in Holland, and really every Dutch player who came after, you know, from Van Dijk to Gullit to Dennis Bergkamp, they all learned their football from Cruyff. And so, yes, I think mostly we understood. And sometimes, you know, he tried not to be intelligible because he hated losing any argument. So he famously said, if I'd wanted you to understand, I'd have explained it better. So he was this kind of genius with words, but it was a very, they were his own words.
And was he routinely on television? I know he had a paper column for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, for a decade or two, he became a pundit because he was sacked as manager of Barcelona in 1996 when he was only 49. He never really had a job after that, but he would appear on Dutch TV, you know, opining on football. And eventually he stopped because he didn't like the moderator asking him questions. He felt that he should have this kind of right just to talk. And then he'd come home and his wife would say, so what did you say tonight? And he'd say, I have no idea. So, everyone in Holland kind of got used to hearing him. He was the kind of soundtrack to all the football that we played, you know, even in an amateur club like mine, and that you saw. You always thought of it as what would Cruyff say. And that still persists in Holland to this day. And, you know, the manager of the national team, Ronald Koeman, was brought to Barcelona by Cruyff. So there is just a very strong lineage. He is the father of Dutch football.
And is that in any, I mean, I presume that's 99% a blessing. As the years go by, is there any part of that that's a curse in any respect?
Yeah, it did become a curse because one of his bitterness, and he was a very bitter man, was that he didn't like club chairmen. He didn't like directors who hadn't played football and were always telling him, you know, fighting with him about money and telling him what he couldn't do. So in 2011, he launched this kind of coup d'etat at Ajax, his, you know, the club where he'd grown up.
Yeah.
And his idea was the club had to be entirely run by Ajax ex-players. So he brought in Mark Overmars and Edwin van der Sar, Dennis Bergkamp to run the club, including the business side, although none of them had any business experience. There was no organizational structures. They all fell out with each other, and Bergkamp ended up being sacked by the others, etc. So there was this enormous mismanagement for a long time before they sorted themselves out. And also Cruyff felt that football was as he'd kind of invented it in the 1970s, and it was never allowed to change or develop.
Right.
So in his view, an outside right had to be a right footer playing on the touchline and outside left footer on the touchline. Of course, football doesn't work like that anymore. You know, we now have players who come cut in from the right and shoot with their left. But he didn't like that. He didn't like any updating of what he had. He didn't like strength training. He didn't like fitness training. He said that's all completely unnecessary. And so he was kind of left behind with time. That happens to most people. You know, most geniuses are unable to... You tend not to stay a genius forever. You have this brief period of incredible creativity, and then that withers. And if you're then extremely stubborn like Cruyff, you think the world is always wrong rather than that you have failed to develop.
You used the word genius there, which I suspect is not even remotely overstating things.
No.
And... You know, you talk about Ajax and growing up in the shadow of the stadium, and his mother cleaned the dressing rooms, I think, for a time as well. By 15,
that's right,
he was training with the first team, at 15 years of age, training with the first team. Debut at 17. Like, are we overstating things to almost suggest that his genius and his understanding of the game wasn't, like, cultivated over an early period of his professionalism, that effectively... he arrived as a 17-year-old into that first team with his view of the game fully formed, and he was effectively dictating things. Is that overstating things, or is that pretty much how it's told and remembered?
Well, I mean, he would, as a teenager training with the first team, you know, age 15, 16, before he'd even made his debut, he'd be telling veteran players, you know, Dutch internationals, where to run. And I'm writing this book about FC Barcelona now, partly as a kind of, because I'm obsessed with Cruyff still. And there's a new statue of him outside the stadium, and it shows him in his most characteristic pose, which he's on the ball dribbling, but simultaneously he's pointing with his arms, because he would dribble while pointing at teammates to tell them where to run. And he would kind of have this monologue on the field while he was on the ball, because he was also kind of guiding the entire team. So yeah, he was born with this vision of... you know, obviously Messi or Maradona were better individual players than Cruyff. He was probably the best individual in the world for a year or two. He wasn't a Messi, but what he had was that he could he was the coach on the field. He would move players around. He would say, you move 20 metres up, you move back to right half, that kind of thing. And he did it in real time. I mean, I asked Arsene Wenger once, you know, were you influenced by Dutch football? And Wenger said, yes, very much so. But without a Cruyff, you couldn't play that game because there's no other player who would kind of organize the team in real time. So he had this genius. He came up with it. But what happened is that, like with John Lennon and Paul McCartney, they needed each other. So he comes into the first team, and he's 18. And then this guy called Linus Michels, who's a former Ajax player, becomes the coach. And Ajax are a semi-professional club then, 1965. They're not even the biggest club in Amsterdam. Dutch football is nothing. And Michels comes with this insane idea that he's going to turn Ajax into a great club. And he and Cruyff together over the next few years, sort of like Lennon and McCartney, developed this new kind of constant moving football of 11 defenders and 11 attackers. And they get on each other's nerves immensely. They irritate each other enormously. But they kind of grow together. So like with most stories of genius, it's not one person by himself, it's two.
Mm. Yeah, it's fascinating. And what illustrates the point you make about Cruyff, the player, is that when he was 36 years of age, I think, when he was back in Holland finishing out his playing days, Ajax wouldn't pay him enough. So he switched to Feyenoord and he won the league title again in his final season in Holland. Now at 36, his powers as a player are on the wane, but clearly the intellect is just so incredible that he's able to almost orchestrate Feyenoord players around him and win a league title.
Yeah, I was reading there's a couple of big new books about him out in Holland. I was reading one, and I was remembering Cruyff could see the game like a great player could. So you can't think, I know what's going to happen three moves from now, because in football, you know, the game is too scattered, it breaks down too quickly. But what you can see is, I can see what might happen in three moves from now if you're a great player. And so Cruyff would think, when his team had the ball, he'd be thinking of what happens when this attack breaks down, because 90, 95, 99% of attacks break down. And he was thinking, when this attack breaks down, they're going to attack over the right wing. So age 36, 37, he'd suddenly have to sprint to the left back position, knowing that the ball might come there and that might be dangerous. And none of his other teammates could see that because they weren't great players. And so it struck him that his teammates were thinking, when they were attacking, I'm going to score a goal, I'm going to score a goal. And they'd all be running into positions to score that goal, which typically they didn't. And he was the only one who was thinking beyond that. So, he had this genius of vision, and his body was completely broken, age 37, and yet he led this very mediocre Feyenoord team to the Dutch title.
I read in one of your pieces that Michels hired not one, but two psychologists to try and understand Cruyff better. So that was a tempestuous relationship, to say the least, I presume.
Yeah, I think psychoanalysis is just was quite in Holland in the 60s. And these two guys, you know, Cruyff had this father obsession. So he'd lost his father, and then his father-in-law became his surrogate father. And Michels was a bad father. So Michels was the father who disappoints, who's too hard, who's an autocrat. So he would tell his psychologists about this. And one of them actually, I think the guy's now dead, but his notes have been preserved. There's an archive. And so there's a fantastic insight into Cruyff was a completely screwed up, bizarre, difficult, impossible man who left everywhere with conflicts. But, you know, what a rich subject.
Mm-hmm. You may not be able to answer this. I don't know if he was ever asked this or if he reflected on this, but you mentioned the conflict, this ever-present in his professional life. Some people get into conflict and they're filled with a sense of remorse or regret afterwards in their camera moments. It scars them. In some respects, other people can only still see it from their point of view and still think, well, you know, I had to stand up for myself and do the right thing, and I was absolutely, you know, it was absolutely appropriate to get into a fight with that person and that person and that person. Was Cruyff in the former camp or the latter?
When he had conflict with football people, he had conflict with almost every great player he ever played with or coached. He would get over it quite quickly. So at Ajax, you know, he had terrible conflict with his player, Frank Rijkaard, and Rijkaard walked out and actually didn't play football for some weeks. But 20 years later, Cruyff tells Barcelona to hire Rijkaard. He'd had no success as a manager, to hire him as coach of Barcelona, and they won the Champions League with him. So, he got over these things quite quickly. He believed in what he called the conflict model, which was that if you create a conflict in a team, then everybody is given an incentive to perform better. It puts everyone on edge, makes them concentrate, which I think was just a kind of justification for the fact that he really liked conflicts. And so he saw this as a kind of excuse to generate them. But yeah, he didn't seem able to live without them.
Was he a better player or a better manager?
He was a player and manager at the same time. He was a manager on the field, and when he became a manager, he said what he liked most was joining in training. And his favourite exercise was the kind of piggy-in-the-middle exercise that Barcelona do. So he'd have four on the outside, two on the inside, and you just have to pass it around and not be intercepted. And he would show the players how to do it because nobody had a better understanding of passing in space. I mean, for him, football was all about passing in space. Mm. So he was both at the same time, always.
Mm. In his final years, how did he tend to spend his time? Was he still in love with the game, professing on the game? I know he did write a column up until relatively late on.
Yeah, he would talk about it a bit. I mean, I interviewed him in this in his villa in Barcelona, and this is 20 years ago. And he had all these TV channels, and he would, you know, flip between different matches because he would get bored with them quite easily. He had this foundation which he ran. May not have been the most professional operation in the world, but he was very committed to it. It did a lot of work with disabled children. So that became kind of his chief passion. Because he was so difficult, Barcelona sort of pushed him out. Mm. And didn't let him get involved in any decision-making. And even his appointees at Ajax, he broke with them in the end, the guys he'd installed at the top of the club, Overmars and Van der Sar. So at the end, he'd kind of been completely detached from football because nobody was able to work with him anymore.
There's a text in asking you about 1978. So Cruyff he played in the 1974 World Cup final. I think there was some kind of tabloid sting on the eve of the final, and domestically, he had to spend a lot of emotional energy on the phone, I think, to family back home to reassure them that there was no truth in what was being reported. So that's kind of a memory of the 1974 final, I think. 78, someone's asking, he elected not to play, always been subject to lots of rumour. Does Simon know exactly why he didn't play in 78?
Yeah, I mean, he was a family man. He was very devoted to his family because he'd lost his dad. And he had found the month or so of separation from the family in 1974 very difficult. And, you know, he to keep his wife on board, he resolved he wasn't going to go away again. And there was this German tabloid story about young women in the Dutch camp, which was very difficult for him. There was a false story that he didn't go to Argentina in protest against the Argentine military regime. That's not true at all. He wasn't really politically committed at all in any way. So it was a family thing, but also he was a chain smoker. He was an extremely unfit man. He could barely jog to the end of his street, somebody once reported. And so he declined very early physically, and he didn't want to go to a World Cup in 1978 when he was 31. Past his best. He felt he was setting himself up for a humiliation. Mm. So it was also that he was past his prime.
So on a global scale, TV being what it was in the 70s, the 74 World Cup was probably his great personal showcase, was it?
Yeah, I mean, when he died, it struck me that for people who lived in the Netherlands or in Spain at the time, I think, and like football, we kind of knew him because we saw him every week on TV and talking. And the rest of the world barely knew him because most football, of course, was barely televised outside the country it was played, or even inside the country it was played in those days. So if you were, let's say, Irish or English, your view of Cruyff would have been just that World Cup 74. It was the only major tournament he ever played in. And so for people outside the Netherlands and Spain, that is the Cruyff they know, the Cruyff of those very small handful of matches.
Mm. Just a final point. You mentioned there you're somewhat obsessed with Cruyff, Simon, and in some respects, I don't really need an explanation as to why. I mean, he's clearly fascinating in 20 gazillion different ways. But if you had to boil down the root of your obsession with Cruyff, or what ultimately it is of Cruyff that appeals to you, what is it?
Brilliant footballer, bizarre man, and the guy who reinvented football. I mean, I think I said in that FT article, it was as if he was Edison and the light bulb in one. He saw the game and he played the game like nobody else. He invented a kind of football that is still the roots of how Barcelona play, how Germany play. It's never gone away, how Manchester City play.
Mm. Listen, Simon, stay safe. Strange and difficult times, but appreciate your time this evening. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
That's Simon Cooper there. Back in one sec.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
Now, you're welcome back. Let's go to Paddy Agnew, who is standing by, I presume, still just at your home outside Rome, Paddy.
Yeah, absolutely, Joe. Still in lockdown, and I suspect I'm going to be in lockdown for quite some while.
I suspect you are. Last time I checked, and this will change by the minute, unfortunately, but I saw that there were 60,000 plus people infected in Italy with 5,476 odd deaths. And I'm sure that has already ticked along.
Oh, it has. Yeah. It is, Joe. We've got practically 7,000 deaths now.
Right.
And 70,000 people, 70,000 cases.
It doesn't take long for the numbers to be dated.
No, they change every night. I mean, we all sit here and we wait for a bulletin that's sent to us from the Civil Protection and the Ministry of Health. And it's just it's a question of counting up the grisly toll and was this higher, was this lower. The last 2 days, the number of deaths had gone down. Today, it's gone up again. So that you can't say yet that we've passed the peak of this. Indeed, the medical authorities have said throughout that this week, by the end of this week, maybe we might be past the peak.
Right. That was going to be my next question, because I had seen those reports in a few places that on Saturday there were 793 deaths, and then that was down to 651 on the Sunday. So there was maybe a hope. I think everybody is just willing that the high point of that curve is behind Italy. So it's up again today, unfortunately.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Okay. I was in a press conference today, even though on lockdown we're all working from home, so we had a web on air video link up with the mayor of Bergamo. Bergamo, obviously the home of Atalanta, but the epicenter of the Italian epidemic. And he's as much in the dark as you and me are as to when this will end or how it will end. And he continues to expresses he's very worried. He's a very worried man and doesn't quite see a light at the end of the tunnel yet.
Yeah. It is just incredible. And we've seen a couple of reports from hospitals in Lombardy, which has obviously been so dreadfully hit, and you're watching people effectively dying with no family around them, and then it's off to the crematorium, and we've seen the army trucks and no family gathering. And I can only imagine the trauma for those families to not be able to grieve in the appropriate way. How is Italian news dealing with this? How graphic are they being? Is there a sense that maybe the people can only take so much?
Well, no. I mean, there's no sense that the people can only take so much in that everybody wants to know what's happening. But, you know, the number of TV crews and people are out there is limited. They are not allowed. You might have seen, some of our viewers might well have seen a British Sky story done from Bergamo.
Yes, that was the one I saw, why I asked almost, is there a sense that the Italian public don't necessarily need to see those pictures night after night?
Well, no, they've been seeing very similar pictures for the last 3 weeks, so I don't think, I think it was a much bigger shock for a British audience and an Irish audience than obviously for the Italians have seen that.
Yeah, no, it certainly was. The mood around where you are, you see shows of defiance and you see people applauding from the balconies or singing. There must be parts of Italy where even singing in the balcony is just kind of too much to contemplate right now.
No, well, I mean, I spoke last week to a mate of mine, Carlo Calvanese, who writes for L'Eco di Bergamo, which is the local paper in Bergamo. And Bergamo is the center, the epicenter of this epidemic. And he said, and we move into football here, because he said, you know, he's a football writer. For the last 3 or 4 years of the Atalanta fairy tale and their rise to the quarterfinals of the Champions League, the support for the club in the town was just fantastic. It's a 120,000 town, but, you know, when they played Valencia in the second round first leg game, like 40,000 of them, that's a third of the town, travelled down to Milan to watch the game because Atalanta are at the moment playing the Champions League games in the San Siro in Milan because they're doing a renovation job in their own stadium in Bergamo. But what Carla was saying to me was, you know, that at that time, while that was going on, to an awful lot of people, it seemed like it was the most important thing in the world. And the sense of buzz about the town was just incredible. But he says that's changed. He said nobody's buzzing now. He said there's one town in Italy where nobody's out on their balconies singing, and that's Bergamo.
Yeah.
I mean, the rate there, the mortality rate is just too high. But Joe, let me tell you one other thing. It's very, very interesting, and again, it's football linked. And it is that one of the senior doctors at the Giovanni XXIII Hospital here in Bergamo, he's convinced that Champions League first leg home tie in Milan that I just mentioned, that was basically what he called a biological bomb. Because what happened was that 40,000 Bergamo fans all travelled down to the match together. They celebrated a bit before, they celebrated a bit afterwards, they came home. And what they didn't realise was that a lot of them were infected because at that point, the time that match was played on the 19th of February, not a single person had died in Italy. 3 weeks later, 333 people died in 1 week in Bergamo. So, what the scientists now believe, what the medics now believe is that, you know, an awful lot of those people are carriers. They went to that match and then they came home and they went, and you know, a lot of Italian families live in a very extended family unit and they brought home a lot of infection to a lot of old people, and a lot of old people have accordingly died. And it's in keeping with that, speaking to the Mayor Gori today, when we asked him about that match, he said he doesn't know whether or not, he said there are other reasons why the virus spread so fast and so vigorously in Bergamo, but that has certainly been a major reason. Mm. And he looks at, he said another thing, spontaneously said he cannot understand how important countries, Britain and the USA in particular, he mentioned, how come they haven't learned from the Italian experience? Italy was the first country to be hit. Italy is ahead of the curve in that sense. Look at what's happened in Italy and realise that one thing you can't do is have mass gatherings. You can't, and you know, the Italians didn't know that at the time of the Atalanta-Valencia game. They know it now.
Yeah.
And he himself, the mayor, he has two daughters studying in England. And when he saw that the British authorities were happy to have England play Wales at Twickenham in front of 80,000, or to have 250,000 racing people at Cheltenham for 4 days, he rang his daughters immediately and said, come home. You'll be safer here than you will be in a country like that. This is the mayor. Because, you know, all the best advice from the Chinese, the South Koreans, now the Italians, is lockdown means lockdown, and it certainly means no mass gatherings. No gatherings at all, let alone ones of 250,000 people. That seems like pure madness. And if you look at the Valencia, the Atalanta-Valencia game, nothing happening at the time that they go to the match. But if you catch the virus, it takes about 5 or 6 days to incubate. Then it takes about 2 weeks to work its course to the point where you're very sick and you recover, or you're very sick and you die. And that's, if you take those 3 week periods from that first game, you get to the week when 333 people died in Bergamo. That boom is, they're absolutely convinced is linked. And as I say, people here look at that and think, you know, shutdown means shutdown. Mm.
That's a dreadful legacy for that game, isn't it? Atalanta, Valencia.
It is terrible, yeah.
19th of February. I can answer your question, I think, about the US and the UK in two words. Boris and Donald, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think we'd agree.
And I see actually the Valencia squad, they announced 35% of their squad and staff tested positive for coronavirus, which, you know, strengthens the feeling about that game in Milan.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, some of the Italian authorities think that maybe they brought a bit of the virus with them, but they certainly picked up, if they didn't, they certainly picked it up in Bergamo.
What's the feeling on Serie A then? Will it be null and void, lockdown? Is there a feeling they will get this played at some stage?
Well, there's with no light to be seen at the end of this particular tunnel, a lot of people are getting very, very skeptical as to whether we'll get it going again. And, you know, significantly, Lazio, who are, you know, second in the league at the moment and having their best year for their best season for years, they were very, very keen to announce that they'd be officially restarting training on Monday of this week, you know, yesterday. For obvious reasons, because this has been a great year for them. They don't want to lose it. They're terrified that the whole season's going to be halted here and now, and the chance of winning the title will be gone. Even they, though, yesterday had to acknowledge that it's absolutely not realistic to be talking about starting training again in a situation where, the longer it goes on like that, the physically just going to run out of time to get play out. But there are a number of possibilities that they keep out on the table. One is that they will start at the beginning of June and they'll play into July, which is the most unusual thing to do for the Italians, because July here in a lot of parts of Italy is very hot. They might do that. They might have a final four, top four play out sort of tournament to decide it. Or they might just stop where it is and say Juventus have won the title.
Yeah. You mentioned there about the young people going to the Atalanta-Valencia match and then bringing the virus home to their families. And, you know, Italy has been such a perfect storm for this in so many unfortunate ways. The family setup is so enshrined. You know, you still have grandparents and grandkids very close together, and that Italian family unit is not a cliche for a reason. Plus, you have an aging population increase. You know, the more we read about Italy, and you know, we've heard for a long time about the Mediterranean lifestyle and diet. So there is an aging population there, so vulnerable and surrounded by grandkids, and in the big cities, small tight apartments, and stopping this thing becomes the mammoth task that it has become.
Yeah, I think you've touched on exactly the reason why it spread so virulently. We actually asked Mayor Gori of Bergamo this morning, and he indicated some of those some of the points that you've just made out. He also Italy's problem was that Italy was the first European country to be badly affected, and Mayor Gori again and plenty of other people have said this, they are now convinced that the virus has been in Italy since the beginning of January, that GPs and doctors dealing with it in January in that part of Italy, we're talking about northeast of Italy, Lombardia, the area around Milano, and the doctors and the GPs just didn't realise what it was. They thought it was in the coldest time of the year, it was just a January flu or maybe a January pneumonia, but nothing to worry about. And it was well into February before, towards the end of February, before it was actually diagnosed as, COVID-19. Yeah. And that gave the virus a good month, if not longer, to play around in Italy and spread itself all about, and particularly all about that region of the Lombardy region. Yeah. And then, as you point, the other thing you can't say often enough, you said it, Italy's got, 22% of its population are over 65. You know, by comparison, Ireland, 13% of the population are over 65. And the Irish 13% most often do not live in the same house as the under 20s. In Italy, in a lot of occasions, as you said, they're all living together. And that was the problem about the Atalanta-Valencia game, that they all brought it back from that match and they took it home with them to their grandparents.
Yeah. One last question. I wasn't too sure. To what extent has it migrated south and towards Rome, or is it still very much focused in that north, that wealthy region, Lombardy, and around the northern part of the country?
Well, that's the epicenter, but it's all over the country now. There's no question of that. The 2 weeks ago, when the government introduced its first emergency lockdown decree, there was a cabinet leak before it was actually officially confirmed. A lot of people listened to the leak and they rushed to the stations. A lot of people who were living in the north, I'm talking about a lot of southerners who live, work, study in the north, about 30,000 of them managed to jump on buses, trains, cars and come south immediately before the decree was put into effect. And in so doing, they did another great job in spreading the virus, despite calls from their regional governors, people in Puglia and Basilicata and Calabria, don't come home, don't bring the disease back to your own homeland. But a lot of them did.
Yeah, indeed. Final thoughts. You're obviously becoming accustomed to the business of quarantine / self-isolation. Any tips for those of us here who are a couple of weeks behind and trying to get to grips with the new norm?
Well, it depends. It depends on your existing lifestyle and your age. But I mean, to some extent, I've been in self-isolation for the last 30 years. So to some extent, I mean, for me, life is very much, I see nobody whatsoever. I'm allowed to walk the dogs in a 300-meter area around where I live. But I live, Joe, in rural Lazio. Yeah. There's, you know, a wood behind me, and there's almost no neighbours around it. And I see nobody other than the wife. And that's the way it is a lot of the time. The breaks in my life are when I go into a press conference in the Vatican or in the Prime Minister's office, or go to a football match at the Olympic Stadium. Yeah. Well, they're the things I can't do now, and I can live without most of them, basically.
Good man. Well, listen, we'll check in again soon. Thanks for that. Thanks for filling us in, Paddy. Appreciate it.
Okay. Cheers. Good talking to you.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, the greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.